Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Uprising Uncut. I am your host for the next 30 minutes, Sonali Kolhatkar, and by day I host the program Uprising, heard on Pacifica Radio, generally on KPFK, but these days more so on KPFA in Berkeley. And I was supposed to record this podcast yesterday on Thursday, and I totally forgot. So I'm a day late, but at least I didn't skip a week this time. I forgot because I've been working from home quite a bit these days since my hours were cut at KPFK, and the sordid reasons behind that can be found in various forms online. But what it's done is it's caused me to lose track of the days of the week. And so yesterday I went to bed and realized as I was going to bed that I totally forgot to record the podcast. So sorry, it's a day late. I wanted to begin the podcast by focusing on an issue that I briefly talked about last week, and that is The Intercept published a series of documents, a cache of classified documents that it had obtained from an anonymous source that they are calling the drone papers. I referred to this last week. And since last week's podcast, I've had the chance to study them a lot more carefully, study the excellent collection of articles and reports that The Intercept put out on these drone papers a little bit more carefully as well. And in fact, I wrote my article, my weekly column on truthdig.com this week about the drone papers. By the way, if you're able to hear that helicopter in the background, that is because I'm sitting next to an open window, and police helicopters occasionally like to patrol my neighborhood. I do not live in the fanciest part of town, which I'm very proud of. And so we often get police patrol helicopters. Anyway, the drone papers by The Intercept, if you haven't yet heard about them or you missed last week's podcast, do check them out at theintercept.com. I believe they're still on the front page, or just Google the drone papers. And so I did write this week about the drone papers for Truthdig, and I was really happy to do so because I was kind of shocked at how little media coverage there's been. This is a huge, huge revelation. Like, Edward Snowden, who's been on Twitter for like 2 or 3 weeks and has already amassed like millions of followers, tweeted that something to the effect that these papers were the most important national security story of the decade. I'm paraphrasing him. And the New York Times and the Washington Post have yet to cover them. I mean, that's just pathetic. But these papers show not only how the drone program works in countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, but how flawed they are. That even those men that the United States lists as targets, enemy targets, high-value targets, that the president personally takes responsibility for being on a so-called kill list, that these drones end up killing way more people that are not intended to be targeted. In one instance, in a 5 or 6 month period in Afghanistan, 90% of the people killed were not on the intended target list. That's how flawed this program is. Now, if you believe that the drone program is, in theory, a good thing, that we drop bombs by remote control from the other side of the planet onto unsuspecting people based on intelligence that involves cell phone metadata, then you might be very, very upset by the statistic that 90% of people who were killed were not the intended target. However, I think we need to step back and question the fact that we're killing anybody at all. Even if the drones killed only people that the US decided should be killed, I don't believe that that in any way justifies the program. And actually, I was able to put it much more eloquently, I think, in writing than I'm doing right now. So I should just read to you this one paragraph from my Truthdig article. Here it is. If the drone wars are simply targeted assassinations, and if the US posthumously designates most victims as enemies, then it is irrelevant how many people are intended for killing and how many are accidentally killed. Rather than differentiating between intended targets and unintended targets, we ought to view every single person killed by drones as innocent, given that none of them has ever been tried in a court of law or been sentenced to death. In fact, in a court of law, President Obama would be tried for masterminding countless murders across international borders. Yeah, I said it. I mean, really. I think we need to put it in perspective and very clearly see what the president is doing as masterminding murders. Within our country, we don't have one person in a position of authority deciding based on spy agencies' intelligence that that person deserves to die, let's take them out. We have these things called trials. We have legal proceedings. People have the right to legally defend themselves in court and make the case that they might be innocent of the crime for which they're being charged. And if they are convicted, only if they're convicted, they are then sentenced. And they're usually not sentenced to death. We don't sentence, most of the sentences we give out are not death by execution. So the fact that the president, who has very openly admitted, in as much as anything about the drone war is open, it's basically this giant open secret that we tend to not discuss in Congress, but he has essentially said that he is taking personal responsibility for the people who are on the kill list. He's admitted that he is masterminding murders. International murders, murders across international boundaries of people that he and his intelligence team have decided should die, but a court of law has not decided. And so if we believe that people in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Afghanistan have just as much a right to life, to justice as we do, then President Obama is simply singling them out for murder. And then also, of course, our drone program ends up murdering a bunch of other people that we weren't intending to murder. Regardless, none of them have been charged, convicted, sentenced. So I just think that we have to put in perspective. We have to see that. Then and only then will we, I think, be outraged enough to stop this insanity. And this is the future of war. This is where the Pentagon is headed. This is where our Defense Department is headed, to make all wars into these remote controlled wars where you identify a person against whom, you know, you haven't declared any kind of war against, you have whom you haven't charged, in a country against whom you haven't declared any kind of war, and you might use their cell phone signal to determine where they are, and you would drop a bomb on them. Problem solved, end of story, you go home. Of course, problem not solved, because what you do when you fight wars in this way is you just anger a bunch of people who want to get back out there and kill us for what our country is doing. And would we blame them? I mean, how would we feel being patrolled in the skies by the remote controlled drones of another country that occasionally drop bombs on our heads and kill us? No. So this is just, it's just such a huge mess, and it's so wrong on so many levels. And the New York Times and Washington Post have conveniently ignored the drone papers. That's not to say that they have ignored the drone wars. They have actually covered the drone wars, but they have ignored this very important revelation of classified information that an anonymous source who is a whistleblower has given to The Intercept. The other big news that happened this week, which is kind of, you know, tiring that it's news still, is the Clinton House Committee hearing, House Select Committee on Benghazi hearing, on the 2012 U.S. Embassy attack in Benghazi, Libya, that the Republicans have been attempting to blame Clinton for since 2012, for the past 3 years. And of course, it was a horrific attack. September 11th, 2012, U.S. Embassy in Benghazi was attacked. A number of people died, including the ambassador, J. Christopher Stevens. And there have been 7 hearings in the House and Senate that have attempted to, you know, find somebody to blame. And Hillary Clinton was once more put on the spot. Interestingly enough, by the way, most major media declared her the kind of supreme winner of that little political showdown. And many just decided she just appeared so presidential in fighting off or managing to stand up for herself in the face of these hearings. And she basically turned it around into a campaign issue, into a campaign move, and that benefited her presidential campaign. Okay, so clearly this targeting of Clinton is political. However, somebody screwed up on security in Benghazi, and nobody's going to end up being accountable. And if anybody is held accountable, it would be the Republicans holding Hillary Clinton accountable, which is, of course, highly, highly politicized, partisan, and not for the right reasons. To the New York Times' credit, even though they ignored the drone papers, this morning, that's Friday morning, they published a very good op-ed called "Forget Benghazi, What About Libya?" And that's the thing that has just been striking me, you know, in the lead up to these hearings and after the hearings as well. Libya is burning. Libya has been destroyed. And you can trace that destruction right back to the US-led NATO war, the brief war on Libya that took out Muhammad Gaddafi, by all standards, a brutal dictator who should never have been defended. I mean, he stands alongside Saddam Hussein, okay? So let's just put that out there. No one's defending Muammar Gaddafi. He did not deserve to remain in power. He screwed over the Libyans, painfully presided over a horrific dictatorship. Still, the US, in bumbling through into Libya with NATO, just like they did in Iraq, laid bare that country's problems and kind of unleashed this Pandora's box of various rebel groups. And I mean, that's the thing. Whenever we talk about solving problems through wars, somehow the hundreds of years of history that show that, generally speaking, wars only unleash more chaos, wars only make things worse, tend to not figure into these political calculations. Because, of course, the goal of making things better is usually not the real goal, right? It's a stated goal. The real goal is political supremacy, imperial prestige, intervention. Sometimes it's corporate greed. It's control. It's everything but trying to make things actually better. And so Libya is burning. But the Republicans couldn't care less, because, of course, they were right there alongside the Democrats on being in favor of attacking Libya. If there's one major broad issue that the Republicans and the Democrats tend to agree on, it is being at war in the Middle East, in the Muslim and Arab world. Now, the degree to which these wars are fought, the reluctance or enthusiasm varies between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats tend to be a little bit more reluctant on the surface. Depends on which country, of course. Enthusiastic about Afghanistan, but wary of Iraq, which is what Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama take that position. And the Republicans are generally quite excited about going to war anywhere as fast as possible on any issue with any excuse, except for the libertarian Republicans, who tend to, simply focus on other things at home, but prefer to not have intervention abroad. And so, people didn't talk about Libya. It just, the fact that the country was in chaos and falling apart, it just didn't figure into the conversations in the congressional hearings on Benghazi. And that's just really sad. That's a sad statement on our political discourse in Congress. One bright spot this week in the Muslim and Arab and world in the Middle East is that the U.S. nuclear deal with Iran is considered a done deal, and Iran is moving to end and lift or be able to operate under the lifted sanctions which many Iranians are no doubt excited about. And on that topic, I'm so excited about something really, really cool and amazing that I got to do this week, which is I got to interview the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize winner Shirin Ebadi on Uprising. I did the interview yesterday, Thursday. It aired on Friday on KPFA in Berkeley. If you're a Los Angeles listener and you didn't get to hear the regular version of Uprising, you can listen to the interview with Shirin Ebadi on my website, uprisingwithsonali.com. But it was really exciting. I got to interview this pretty amazing woman. She, you know, she's had to toe a very tough line as a highly educated dissident lawyer from Iran. She has had to pick and choose her battles, how hard she, you know, needed to fight without challenging authority so much that she would basically end up being imprisoned and tortured. And she, by the way, has actually been held accountable by the authorities on many occasions, but she's walked a careful line and I think quite deftly avoided it while staying true to her principles. When she was given the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003, by the way, she became the first Muslim woman and the first Iranian woman to have ever won the prize. The fact that she was the first Muslim woman was just kind of sad. I mean, there are a billion Muslims on this planet. And you know, of course, not very many women have even been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, but things are slowly changing. But that was just really cool for me to be able to talk to her. And she was, she made this really interesting point during our conversation, which is that, you know, I asked her if the U.S., if she supported the U.S. nuclear Iran deal, if she supported the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal. I had one too many margaritas this evening, by which I mean I had one. And she said, yes, she absolutely supported the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal. However, she also later in the interview talked about how Iran under President Hassan Rouhani, who's supposed to be much more moderate compared to his predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, under Rouhani's rule, human rights and women's rights in Iran just haven't changed that much. And of course, that is because the religious authorities in the country are not elected. They serve life terms. And so the president just doesn't have that much power. And so I asked her, I said, you know, does the U.S.'s willingness to warm relations with Iran end up condoning Iranian human rights violations by the government? Even though, of course, the U.S. should never abuse its leverage with countries to hold anybody accountable for human rights because of its own human rights hypocrisy, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't bring that part up. But just, you know, on the surface, I asked her whether by dealing with Iran, the U.S. was essentially patting a human rights violator on the back. And she was really clear. She said, these are two separate things. There's the issue of Iranian global standing, and there's what happens inside in Iran. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, the U.S. doesn't like to separate those two issues except when it is useful or politically, politically useful for the U.S. to do it. And then when it is politically useful for the U.S. to separate them, it does separate them. For example, Saudi Arabia, right? It's more useful for the U.S. to look the other way with Saudi Arabia's human rights violations while continuing to deal with Saudi Arabia on an international level. Iran is not as out of control as Saudi Arabia and its human rights violations. What's interesting, of course, is in Iran, there you have a highly educated population that has come quite close to overthrowing the current regime, and of course has a history of revolutions where they have actually overthrown abusive powers. So I think actually on the issue of U.S.-Iran relations, this is a case where it really does make sense for the U.S. to just simply butt out and stay out of Iranian human rights violations, because the U.S. can't really make things better, A, because of its own hypocritical position, and B, because doing so would really interfere with Iran and possibly strengthen the hand of the religious authorities. And also because Iranians are really quite capable of standing up for themselves And I don't think it's going to come from the U.S. to help Iranians, the U.S. government, I should say, to help Iranians fight for their own human rights. Now, U.S.-Iranian solidarity, people to people, is a whole different thing. And there are other international mechanisms. Anyway, it's a nuanced issue because I'm almost, as I'm saying it, as I'm explaining it, I'm seeing both sides of the issue. It's complex, and I don't feel completely convinced of what I just said. I really think that these are things worth exploring because, you know, certainly on the one hand, the U.S. should not do business with or have relations with human rights violators. On the other hand, what right does the U.S. have to even speak about human rights violations? And on the third hand, if the U.S. doesn't, then, or if you know, if those things don't arise during diplomatic interactions, then when should they arise? Shouldn't they arise somehow, somewhere? And of course, the United Nations was created as a way to address these issues, but the UN is completely powerless these days, or seems to be powerless, and much of that powerlessness comes from U.S. undermining. So we come back to the U.S. Anyway, thoughts worth exploring, but those are my thoughts on it. On local news, or domestic news, I should say, here in the United States, a couple of really interesting issues that I wanted to talk about on the podcast. One was that the Black Lives Matter movement. Gosh, I love this movement. These people, these activists, these visionary thinkers who are leading this movement, they're pretty amazing. They have offered so many lessons, so many inspiring examples of how you organize in such a short period of time. Whoever is making decisions has studied history really well. So the Black Lives Matter movement asked or demanded both the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee to have separate debates for their party candidates vying for president to focus specifically on the injustices facing the Black community in the United States. And the Democratic National, I actually don't know what the RNC said, but the DNC said, yeah, of course, we passed a resolution in support of Black Lives Matter. We're on your team. We're the party that Blacks should vote for. But then they turned around and said, we'll give you a town hall. Not a debate. We'll give you a town hall. And Black Lives Matter said no. I mean, when was the last time a progressive movement had this much leverage with the Democratic Party? It's brilliant. It's the right time to do it. There's no better time to hold a major party's feet to the fire than in an election year. And actually, of course, we're not yet in an election year. Technically, there's still more than a year before the actual election. But the election season has started so early, which we can use to our advantage. We, meaning activists, progressive activists, can use to our advantage. When was the last time? The last time that any movement was able to hold a major party's feet to the fire was when the Tea Party did it. And look what they gave us, right? So Black Lives Matter said, no, we don't want your damn town hall. There's plenty of town halls. You know, we want a debate. And I'm impressed. So here's what I'm impressed about. First of all, they're engaging with the political process, right? They did that when they held Bernie Sanders, when they confronted Bernie Sanders at these major political events. So they're not disengaged from the electoral political system, which I think is important because many movements tend to either be completely focused on that or completely divorced from that. And I don't think either is really the right path. So they're engaging with the electoral political system. However, they're doing it on their terms. And they're demanding that a major political party follow them, earn their votes. Right? So they're saying, no, we are demanding a debate. And I just was really happy about that. And I would love to see Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley fall over themselves to prove why they are more deserving of Black votes than their rivals. Right? Let's, you know, enough with bending over backwards to prove to the business community or to rural white voters or to Christian voters or any of those other groups that the major parties are constantly fearful of having to appease. For once, they would, in a debate that was focused entirely on the injustices facing the Black community, they would be forced to directly prove that they are the party that Black America should support. I mean, it's just brilliant. Good for them. So let's see where that, good for Black Lives Matter. And that's good for all of us. You know, when I say good for them, I really mean good for us. Good for us Americans. Good for every single one of us who lives in a country where Black lives in the society seem to be worth so much less. I don't want to live in that country. I don't want my children to grow up in a country where a whole section of our society and our community fears so much more than others, that they, you know, fears being gunned down by police, fears being criminalized, fears being demonized, fears not getting a job, fears being turned down for a home loan or a business loan because of the color of their skin, because of their ethnic and racial background. I don't want to live in that country. And so good for us that Black Lives Matter is holding the Democratic Party's feet to the fire. The other big domestic story that I wanted to bring up that hasn't gotten, it's gotten some attention, actually. I take it back. It hasn't gotten as much. It hasn't risen to the level of a major news story, even though it has actually gotten widespread coverage. And that is prison phone calls. Now, it sounds a little esoteric, sounds a little obscure. You know, why should this be an issue? But the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which is, you know, kind of an odd place for this decision to take place, they just slashed the cost of prison phone calls. And it's Federal Communications Commission is this five-person appointed government body. They're appointed by whichever major party is in power. They get three seats and the minority party gets two. And they are supposed to oversee and essentially make sure that the public's well-being is served in all arenas of telecommunications and other communications. Anyway, so I didn't actually realize that it's the FCC's purview, but it is. And they just voted to slash three to two dramatically the price of phone calls that inmates make to their families or their families make to inmates. You wouldn't believe this. In some prisons, phone calls can cost as much as $14 a minute. That's freaking highway robbery. And, you know, we tend to incarcerate the poor in this country. And then we gouge them for the cost of telephone calls as they try to keep the fabric of their family together and simply staying in touch with one another. And in so many cases, the only contact one has with a loved one behind bars is through the telephone, because often prisoners are transferred to facilities quite far away from where their families live. So it costs too much for them to go visit them constantly. And so phone calls are the only means of communications. And when these cost this ridiculous amount of money, as is, you know, almost everything in the prison industry, we're imprisoning people so we can make money off of them. Anyway, I wanted to quote this guy, the Securus Technologies Inc. CEO Richard Smith. He's basically the CEO of one of these main telephone companies that operates within prisons. Securus. I'm assuming that word derives from the word secure or some shit like that. Anyway, he said in a written statement that the FCC's decision is a, quote, colossal error that threatens the financial stability of his company and other inmate phone providers. Oh, poor guy. His financial stability of his company is threatened as he gouges poor people who are behind bars. They are prisoners. They can go nowhere. They have no freedom. And he's worried about the financial stability of his company. And he is defending the worst case of price gouging that I've heard in a long time. He said that Securus which is one of the largest providers of inmate phone services, would join other companies in a request for court intervention. They're legally fighting the FCC on this. It's disgusting. Anyway, big victory for the FCC. And, you know, this happens. These are the changes that happen in the margins when you have a Democratic majority, either in Congress or with the president. And so many issues, on most issues, the two parties are identical, or just as bad as one another, I should say. In the margins, in places like the FCC and the Supreme Court, which can impact people's lives pretty seriously, there's a difference between Democrats and Republicans, and we should always acknowledge that. But of course, we shouldn't use that as an excuse to keep giving Democrats everything that they ask for. Finally, the last thing on this podcast, it's Friday night, and all I can see in the news is this terrifying hurricane that's about to hit Mexico, or has actually already hit Mexico as of my recording, Hurricane Patricia, supposed to be the strongest storm to ever hit the Western Pacific. It's bloody scary. And this is climate chaos, right? Welcome to the era of climate chaos. Incidentally, a few years ago, I read this really bizarre study that exposed the sexism of day-to-day life, that apparently hurricanes that are named after women, that are female names, are actually taken less seriously by people impacted than hurricanes named after men. So Hurricane Patricia, because it's Patricia and not Patrick, may end up, you know, invoking less fear among residents who are supposed to be evacuating than a male named hurricane. Look it up. It's really, really bizarre and terrifying and sad and pathetic. And actually, on the issue of climate chaos, I'm very excited because I am going to Paris. And how are those two things connected? Well, the United Nations Climate Conference, the make or break conference, the big one, COP21, as it's being called, is happening in Paris this December. And Truthdig is sending me to cover the conference. I'm going for the second week of the 2-week conference. And I'm very excited, A, because I've never been to Paris, and B, because, of course, this is a huge opportunity to cover a very, very important event. I haven't traveled very much or had the chance to travel very much on assignment since I had kids. And so I'm excited that I get to go to this conference. It should be pretty amazing. And I'll be writing several columns from there before, during, and after the conference. And we'll also do some radio and possibly video reporting for Uprising. So definitely look out for that. And that brings me to 32 minutes I've gone over. I better end. Thank you so much for listening to another edition of Uprising Uncut. I'll see you next week. Bye.